airing on Asheville FM in Asheville. This is the Final Straw Radio. This week, we're featuring a recent live recorded interview that I did at Firestorm Books with Vicky Osterweil, anarchist author and worker, author of In Defense of Looting, and more recently, The Extended Universe, How Disney Killed the Movies and Took Over the World, Haymarket Books 2026. During the chat, Vicky talks about this latter book, about intellectual property, and how it overlaps between entertainment and other elements like technology and medicine, the shaping and limiting effects IP has on popular culture and imagination, the film industry, and other topics.
Hey, y'all. Welcome to Firestorm. Thanks for being here tonight. We're really excited to be here to talk about, you know, something that we talk a lot about here at Firestorm, Walt Disney. So thank you so much to Vicky for including us on a tour of the East Coast. We really love getting a chance to have authors come through, particularly someone who we adore as much as Vicky. So just to kick us off here tonight, I'm going to share a little quick bio. Also want to give a big shout out and appreciation to Bursts from Final Straw for partnering up with us today on this event and kind of being in the mix as an interviewer interlocutor. So Vicky is a Philadelphia-based writer, agitator, and brick mason whose first book, In Defense of Looting, described historical struggles for liberation in the U.S. She's a member of the anarchist journal CAW and has written about the intersections of film, politics, and culture for publications such as The Paris Review, Art in America, Al Jazeera America, The Baffler, Dissent, Lux Magazine, and The New Inquiry, where she was also a culture editor for many years. Thanks so much for being here tonight to talk about this really unique and interesting book. It was not on my bingo card for anarchist literature in 2026, but I think it actually has an enormous amount to offer in terms of how we understand the world around us. So thank you so much, Vicky. Thank you, Burse. I'm going to pass it off.
Thank you so much. I love it in Firestorm. It's so nice to be here. That is unfortunately the outdated bio. I now work in a warehouse. I'm not doing brick masonry anymore. Although that was much more fun. But yeah. So I'm gonna just start with just a reading. This is from the intro. It's from a section called On Letting People Enjoy Things, and I think it'll give an idea of sort of what the project is and what we're doing here. Why it's worth talking about in the year of everything being on fire and total fascism. While Disney may be one of the most cutthroat and exploitative corporations in the history of the world, may indeed have been a core pillar of American imperial domination, it is also at root a movie studio. And that studio was responsible for some of the most pleasurable experiences of my childhood. While I always preferred Bugs to Mickey, I loved my Rescuers dolls, identified so intensely with Flounder from The Little Mermaid that just thinking about him now spreads a warm feeling through my chest, and saw in Ariel, Belle, and Cinderella the first inkling that I might not actually be the boy everyone insisted I was. I treasured a Jasmine Barbie doll, acquired at a local Disney on Ice production of Aladdin. I can still see the sticky, primary colored snow cone in my hand as we found our seats in the arena. And a few times I chose the Disney princess figurines instead of the Hot Wheels cars when we got McDonald's Happy Meals. Somehow or other, I learned that this was shameful and eventually hid the figurines alongside Jasmine and Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles' girl reporter April O'Neil deep underneath my bed. When I say that Disney is a monster, I say that as one of its spawn. Almost all of us are. It is not a betrayal of our young selves, but rather an act of love and solidarity to insist we deserved better images of gender, of pleasure, of creativity and art and possibility. That we deserve to have our dreams and desires blossom through less restrictive, reactionary cultural pathways. That our minds and imaginations should never have been offered up to a corporation whose total dominance of a particular market segment marked us at our most inquisitive and joyful moments with its image. It is not to reject the beauty and pleasure we found anyway, but to point out that those moments were in the service of molding us into proud citizen serfs of the Magic Kingdom, and that we need to build new ways of thinking and talking about those experiences if we want to stop the cycles of consumption, nostalgia, and ideology they support. Similarly, unlike many books that take a critical look at the role of IP in culture, this book does not argue that the copyright system needs to be reformed, or that in its current form it is somehow a deviation from the proper role of IP in society. This is an abolitionist text, and it comes from the perspective that IP, along with the megacorps it upholds and the broader system of property it is an increasingly central part of, must be overthrown for us to build more sustainable and liberated forms of art, creativity, and childhood. IP is not and was never designed to protect artists and authors, even though they are brought up as moral shields by corporate and financial interests, arguing that their position of monopoly is in fact to the benefit of our culture. This has been the case from the very first patent grant given to inventors in medieval Florence, to the campaigns against library photocopying in the 1960s, to the Disney-driven Sonny Bono Copyright Term Extension Act of 1998. In the piracy wars of the early aughts, media conglomerates largely succeeded through a years-long marketing and lobbying campaign costing hundreds of millions of dollars in convincing regular people that copyright protects artists above all else. And in an internet age where imagery, words, and music are easily reproduced, many artists have had the experience of having their work ripped off on social media. It's no surprise that they come to believe that copyright is their only protection. IP law was designed to guarantee scientific, cultural, and technological progress within a capitalist system that would otherwise tend to privatize and halt that progress. Don't take my word for it. That's how it's written into the Constitution, as a measure designed explicitly to, quote, promote the progress of science and useful arts. The law is meant to promote the progress, not the individuals carrying that progress out. And there is no question that the founding fathers were quite successful in this. The progress of technology, culture, and science in the United States has included incredible advances in medicine, the invention of the telegram and the airplane, the movie camera and the radio, the internet and the mobile phone, the creation of Gatling guns, offshore oil rigs, the automobile and the highway, industrial agriculture, the suburbs, the atom bomb. In 2025, the sum effects of this progress of science and letters put to the service of capital and empire is not human freedom or artistic flourishing, but instead oligopoly, mass incarceration, forever war, and climate destruction. Given that legacy, I believe we should make no excuses for the system of IP and should instead do everything we can to support pirates, whistleblowers, and leakers in their work. Imagine if, in the autumn of 2020, someone within Pfizer or Moderna or the US Patent Office had stolen and publicly released the science behind the COVID-19 vaccine. That hero, no doubt, would have been hunted down and prosecuted, but they might have saved millions of lives in the process. It does us no good to pretend that the IP-based games, shows, and blockbusters we love don't contribute to and emerge from this same world of privatized medicines, agricultural methods, and academic knowledge. As a result, this book is unflinching in its criticism of the ideological content of the movies it discusses. But I hope it also contributes to a mode of cultural criticism that goes beyond trying to draw a one-to-one connection between a film's politics and its quality as entertainment or even art. I like a lot of these movies and truly enjoyed watching most of them. I like them enough to spend years watching, thinking about, and writing a whole book about them, after all. All but the worst gave me moments of genuine joy, pleasure, and admiration. As my friends can attest, I'm a big movie crier. My chin will start to quiver if I hear a certain swelling of strings. I can be set to weeping by depictions of simple gestures of love and kindness. And even though I'm being cheaply manipulated sometimes, in the moment it still feels good and real and can give me space to experience genuine emotional release. I cried many times watching movies that I talk about in this book, and scenes that I critique seriously in this text moved me deeply. Critiquing their function, however, is not meant to deny their power or argue that people enjoying these films are somehow dupes. Quite the opposite. The more effective these movies are emotionally, the more effective they are ideologically. And knowing that doesn't make you immune to their charms. If movies were someone just talking directly to the camera saying, money is good, go to work, be a heterosexual, buy things, be happy with your lot in life. Well, okay, that might be a kind of good piece of agitprop, but it certainly wouldn't have any broad popular appeal. Analyzing movies as commodities helps us break with the ideological fantasies that elevate and idealize art and culture, where art is held separate from the tedious material concerns of everyday life. Creativity is a specialized activity, only available to people who hear its spiritual call, the story goes, not a basic everyday practice, a joy and pleasure that we can find in all our pursuits. As long as culture is so elevated, common sense dictates that the rewards of stardom, acclaim, and fabulous wealth should go to society's most brilliant, skilled, creative people. And if most culture workers are paid pennies to churn out content to line the IP owners' pockets, driven by the fantasy that someday they too will join the pantheon, well, they get to pursue their highest calling, so aren't they lucky to be so exploited? Such vulgar concerns as pay rates and workplace conditions are beneath the shrew artist. And elevating art like this allows corporate powers to defend a media product that costs more than most cities' annual operating budgets, as though it is little different from charcoal sketches made on an easel in some Parisian garret. Still, reducing movies and culture products generally to just their commodity function misunderstands the dynamics of resistance, struggle, and recuperation in the places culture is made and consumed, not to mention the chaos and randomness that often marks the pressure cooker of onset conditions. With so many hands on the wheel, many people contribute their particular perspectives, experiences, and desires into a film. an actor and screenwriter may have different interpretations of a character. A cinematographer and color editor may differ on a particular shade of blue. On the ground, from movie to movie, the way meaning is produced is contingent and chaotic. A major part of the struggle within cultural workplaces hinges on who gets to determine how particular images are made and which stories are told. And each individual movie functions within a broader cultural whole, encompassing the marketing, branding, critical culture, current events, fan discourses, internal corporate politicking, and many, many other contexts that shape both how films are made and how they are received by the public. At the same time that the industrial forces that create a cultural product will always pull it toward being an idealized representation of itself as a commodity, a product designed for creating the most profit with the least friction, it can only do so by selling tickets, by appealing to the mass of viewers. This is an infamously unpredictable process, and we will see how, even as Walt Disney designed his animation studio around principles of control, uniformity, and efficiency, he was still often stymied and on occasion almost ruined by the mercurial tastes of the public. Ultimately, mass culture must piggyback on and recuperate social energies of creativity, desire, conflict, and struggle, relying on ideas that bubble up from below. It is therefore always in danger of reflecting and releasing those energies back to the public. As literary critic Frederick Jameson puts it, works of mass culture cannot be ideological without at one and the same time being implicitly or explicitly utopian as well. They cannot manipulate unless they offer some genuine shred of content as a fantasy bribe to the public about being so manipulated. And there's always the threat of sabotage, of culture workers secretly embedding particular images and ideas, an extra pulling a funny face in the background of a serious scene, or a production designer putting a message of their own choosing on a piece of graffiti, or even just purposely breaking the illusion that the commodity attempts to produce by making things look unrealistic, jagged, or silly. IP, whether in the movies or in culture more broadly, has proven to be extremely useful in putting more power in the hands of the owners and leaving less space for the conflictual energies and tactics described above. Its stories are always within controlled worlds of predetermined and pre-built characters, narrative expectations, and genre constraints. But even still, as visible in the way Black Lives Matter activists made use of Black Panther in 2018, this control is never successfully absolute. Put another way, I can enjoy a bag of potato chips without pretending that the system that made them is just, but also without berating myself that my enjoyment is somehow false consciousness. And when, in the midst of an uprising, people distribute single-serving bags of chips to one another as a form of mutual aid, as I saw again and again on marches during the George Floyd uprisings in 2020, the power and solidarity of that gesture is not extinguished by the fact that, in a better, more just world, there would be more ethically produced treats to affordably share. We should take whatever succor we can from this crumbling system while acknowledging that we too are products of it, that there is no outside of it, and therefore our pleasures, desires, and needs have been shaped indelibly by it, that we don't even know what our desire would look like once truly liberated from the demands of work, the nuclear family, rent, and property.
This is the Final Straw Radio on the Pacifica Network, and you're hearing an event that I co-hosted with author Vicki Osterweil on her recent book, The Extended Universe, How Disney Killed the Movies and Took Over the World. Hey, KPFA listeners, this is Burst from the Final Straw Radio. If you appreciate the perspectives that we share on the show as a thread in the fabric that is this 77-year-old community radio station, now is a great opportunity to show it. I mean, really, where else on the dial are you going to find this event with Vicki Osterweil talking about intellectual property and the history of Disney and the banality of the Marvel comics, the Marvel universe and, where entertainment is and its connection to private property. It's not going to be probably two steps down the dial. Anyway, KPFA could use your one-time or recurring tax-deductible donation of any amount to keep the lights on and the sounds flowing through the airwaves. To do this, you can give a call to 1-800-439-5732, or that's 1-800-HEY-KPFA if you've got a touch-tone phone, where an operator will be happy to help you through the process. If you're not feeling chatty, you can feel free to navigate on over to support.kpfa.org. And besides easy ways to donate, you'll find various thank you gifts available there, great for regifting to that special progressive in your life. I was surprised actually just now perusing it to find the book Herbalism and State Violence, Practical Herbal Medicine for Surviving State Repression, which is by my friend Nicole Rose out of the UK, who's shown up on the show a few times. And also produces a podcast on Channel Zero Network called Frontline Herbalism, if you want to give it a listen. Anyway, you can find more at the website. Thank you for listening, and we hope that you stay tuned for the rest of this great chat with Vicky Osterweil. On with the show.
That is such a
Vicky, thanks a lot for sharing the book and for being here to chat.
Totally.
So you opened the book also with this example from the Biden administration when Disney lawyers and other Hollywood lawyers show up in front of the Biden administration and plead the case to not share that information about how the COVID vaccine was produced. Can you, I guess, talk a little bit about the overlap between the investment in the protection of IP in the form of characters like Mickey Mouse? I guess it's kind of a moot point at this point,
well, but, sure.
You know, it wouldn't have been, you know, a few years ago, and these sorts of like life-saving technologies.
Totally. Yeah. So basically, like, that was sort of the hook that I would use to tell people when I was explaining why I was writing a book about Disney movies. Okay. And so the thing I would say is, well, you know, it's setting out to answer two questions. Why are all superhero movies the same? And why did Disney and the rest of Hollywood send lobbyists to stop the Biden administration from sharing the coronavirus vaccine with the third world? And why do those questions have the same answer, which is intellectual property management? Because I think if you think about a movie company, if you know anything about movies, you instinctively understand that a global pandemic is a disaster for movies, right? The movie theaters were all closed, right? And obviously, like, filming on set, like if they even get back to being able to aggregate, to film in aggregate, every single day on set is so expensive. The way filming works, it's so intense. And so like having to protect against an outbreak is really expensive. And like one star getting COVID could like bankrupt an entire movie, right? So it just like instinctually makes sense. Like why wouldn't they be super invested in making COVID end as quickly as possible? It's because Disney's not a movie company. Disney is an IP protection company. In 2018, which was the year that Disney had the largest monopolistic share of the movie industry of any year I looked at. I mean, I looked at like sort of the 30s as well, because that was when monopolies got really intense. So in 2018, Disney made $1.1 billion on 10 movies. That was 37% of the global cinema market. That is a larger monopoly share of a global market than almost any single corporation has had on anything. You know, I mean, it's just mass. You know, sometimes the percentages don't feel, but 37% is wild. And that year, that was 16% of their total revenue. So like even, you know, when they had the best year any movie company had ever or will ever have in the history of movies, it was not even a fifth of their business. So movies are just really expensive and profitable advertisements for the rest of their business empire. Merchandising, education, theme parks, obviously, cruise ships. They have venture capital firm. The GoPro is a Disney product. There's less money in it now, but music and books was also like a big sideline for them. There's just like this sort of massive, massive corporation. And through across the entire corporation, characters are the lifeblood that brings money in. So when they bought Marvel was that 2013, 2012? It's in the book, the right date. I'm not always great at the numbers like that. They said, and I actually wrote down the quote so that I wouldn't get it right, that because it's so banal that it's like hard to remember it. They described Marvel, now again, they just spent $4 billion on this company. They described Marvel as a character franchise company. That's what they were buying. They were buying characters. So if we think about like what does Meta own, or like you know, any of the software companies, the social media companies, like they don't own the servers usually that run. Most of them just give it to Amazon, right? That's how Amazon's in business. They hold all the other websites. So what they own is the designs, the code, and the sort of like the intellectual property that is like held by their engineers and their designers. And that code, theoretically, you could just highlight and hit copy paste on it, right? There's no, without the state backing up that right of intellectual property, there is no way a software company makes sense and exists. Similarly, like it is quite easy for anyone who could theoretically make a movie about Mickey Mouse is now in the public domain, but about, you know, Han Solo or whatever. And lots of people do that with like fan fiction. And it is the threat of state violence that keeps that valuable and is necessary. So when they sued, and again, they sent 5 lobbyists to the movie industry. Pharma sent 100. To stop the sharing of the coronavirus vaccine, to extend vaccine apartheid, right? Like in the name of COVID, they were defending COVID against its enemies, the vaccine. And the reason that they do that is because there is a probably wrong-headed but strategic legal corporate belief that any threat to intellectual property, even going through this like legal process that it was going through that's actually quite mild and was written into the law about it, any threat like that is a total snowball threat to everything. And that also explains the extreme legal attacks on what seemed to us, and indeed are, very small copyright violations.
So people like pirating videotapes or whatever, getting raided by the FBI.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, especially in the 2000s, there was a lot of that. And I mean, you know, folks like have effectively been stopped from pirating on their computers because there are those automated emails, which I imagine everyone in here has probably received at one point in their life, because you downloaded like an episode of True Blood season 5 or whatever, and it like it uploaded for a second, and your internet provider immediately emailed you saying they're going to cut off your access to the internet, you know? God, that's an outdated reference. Why did that come to my head? Jesus Christ, True Blood, what the f***? I should probably rewatch that. It's been like a decade, and it's probably awful. It's probably awful, right? I don't know. Suki Stackhouse, is that her name?
In one of the best episodes.
Okay, all right. Yeah. You know, you get those warnings, and if you've ever posted anything to YouTube, or if you know about how, like, you know, social media video and audio posting works, there are like robot lawyers crawling them constantly, algorithmically, nuking stuff from orbit that they just claim is a copyright infringement, and the policy of the platform is to delete it, demonetize it and the channel, and it's up to you, the user, to prove that you haven't violated copyright through arcane processes that are totally determined by the corporate power, right? There's this massive apparatus like to wipe out any pseudo threat and to like demonstrate extreme power, precisely because it's all built ultimately like on cop with stick, you know? Like that's the only thing that makes it valuable.
So there's the threat of state imposition, there's a threat of violence if you copy things, you know, if you reproduce. Can you talk a little bit about how this focus on reproducible IP that's owned by the company, that's re-released over and over again, how that shapes the framing of like how movies are made, how culture's produced through legacy sequels and this sort of thing?
Totally, yeah. I mean, I think like I went to the movies this afternoon. I got here a little early, I had some free time, my hosts were working, and I like had a choice, and I could choose between, because it was an afternoon, I could choose between the Michael Jackson biopic, which like absolutely not, obviously, the Super Mario sequel, and the Mummy remake, like the 7th Mummy reboot or whatever. And I like went for the Mummy just because it like felt the least offensive. I was wrong. It was awful. But the point is, like, if you go to the movies, like almost everything is an IP or like based on a true story. That is not the case. That has not been the case historically. I'm going to see if I can flip to him. I probably can't just get there. But I like literally like did, you know, extremely elaborate research. I made charts, you know, I did numbers, not my strong suit, showing that you can see when the, like, how much, by what percentage franchise stuff, like, sort of takes over the entire industry. And it starts really in the 2000s. It starts accelerating in the 2000s. It's always been a part of the movie industry. There were things, they were called serials that go back as far as, like, the 20s with the same character coming over and over again. Obviously, like, early cartoons were all movies, and those had those recurring characters. James Bond is a franchise, right, that has gone on forever. So it's not Sherlock Holmes also, like it's not a new thing, but its concentration as the only thing that's valuable has really transformed our cultural landscape. One example that I really like going to that's in the book, if people remember like in 2018, 2019, suddenly like all movie trailers had like, they would have like these sort of sad girl covers of like pop songs, you know, like just like a sad girl with a guitar, like doing a terrible version of like a Tears for Fears song. You're like, the original Tears for Fears song clearly exists. Like, why is this happening? You know? And you know, I thought at the time it was just some sort of like trend, some weird trend in Hollywood trailer making or whatever. No, actually what happened is with the rise of streaming, the way that copyright works on recordings, on like audio recordings, is that there's a copyright for the particular recording, and there's a copyright for the writing of the song. The writing credits are kept by the artist and are much less valuable. The recording is kept by the studio. What had been happening in the 2010s is that a bunch of investment firms figured out that they could give a big cash payment to, you know, Bob Dylan. You know, he can retire or whatever. Like, he doesn't, you know, he gets $50 million for his kids. And then every time a Bob Dylan song is played, you know, through Spotify or Apple Music, they get that, like, 1/10 of a penny, or not even, like 1/100 of a penny that comes every time that something streams, which, if you're a real regular artist, is you cannot make money like that. Like, selling 1,000 signals as an artist, like, you probably eat for a year. Having you know, someone play, 1,000 people play it as though they own the single, you don't get anything, right? So it's completely destroyed the middle and bottom of the music industry. Anyways, these companies buy them, they buy the rights, and then anytime that song gets played, they get like a little bit. So then it becomes in their interest to get that song played as many times as possible. So suddenly they want to get their old songs in the mouths of new artists, because the new artist then will do it, and then they'll get a play on that version, and then they'll go back to the old version, and they and these music investment firms will get a hit every time, right? Every time you stream either the new one or the old one. So it's really valuable to them. And then ultimately what that means is that the logic of that, the market logic of that is any piece of new music is competition. So it is in your active interest culturally, because if people are playing new music or a new genre, like a totally new genre, like hyper pop or something, and you don't get, you can't ever get any money off of it, that's a real threat to your business model. So it becomes in the interest of IP holders to never let new IP develop, which is to say, never let new creative things be created, like just the old stuff forever. And like, that's really intense and like horrifying that there's a incentive for that. But also it has these weird effects where like, you know, we're shopping in the grocery store and we're hearing this weird Uncanny Valley version of a song we used to love when we were 10, and it produces this sort of like weird mood, or you're like driving and all that stuff is like very minor. These like moments, these affective moments are minor, but they like, are happening to everyone all the time. What is that doing to our culture? How is that producing, say, a desire to make America great again back when the cover was, but it was better than the cover song? You know, like, how is that producing nostalgia and like fear and resentment and like a belief that the past is the only place good things come from? Or some other belief, I mean, I don't know. But you know, like, it's impossible to study, but that's all thanks to this weird arcane loophole some investors found in IP law around recorded music. Who knows, like, I don't know how many other things have been changed like that by things like that.
And I guess when you're considering like the innovation like factor, what you were talking about with the US Constitution, and you go through some of the history of the early days of the US and the colonies, but in particular, once the US gained its independence, a lot of literature being brought in from other countries with a refusal to recognize the copyright from those countries allowed for a flourishing of productivity within the popular culture in the US. It seems like with the concentration, not only the divestment from new production and new productive forms of creativity, but also the probably the active suppression of new pieces of culture, that we're getting fed the same sort of Soylent Green over and over again. And that probably does a lot to increase that uncanny mood.
Yeah. And it shapes what people believe they can do. Because if you don't feel like you can tell a story that anyone's going to like without having legal rights to something, whether or not that's true, that's going to affect your sort of impulse to create, right? And, you know, I think, like, you know, we still see a lot of, obviously, we will always see a lot of creativity. That's not going to go away. But what it does do is it diminishes the belief in the possible, like, through creativity, while also sort of pushing things into certain sort of cultural streams that I think are quite tedious and often generically repetitive and visually ugly, right? Like Marvel movies like are so ugly. Like Marvel movies are so ugly that people thought the Barbie movie was good because they like hadn't seen a saturated color in like 10 years. And they're like, oh my God, the color pink. And it's like, yeah, no, it's good. But like, you know, so like, I think, which of course the Barbie movie then the next week after its opening, Mattel reannounced their theme park in Arizona that was building because they are playing the exact same game. Mario is on the same game. That's why that was at the top of the box office in 2024. And again, this year it's doing quite well. All the companies are doing this now. Everyone is doing it. I think in the last few years, it's something like 95% of all the top 30 movies in the global box office are based on IP. It's everything. And it's not just the movies, right? It's talking about it with music. We see it with video games. Video games, it's a little different because sequels, but we're seeing the video game industry is going through another crash, which it hasn't, you know, it was doing extremely well in the 2010s. And part of that crash is the consolidation into certain IPs like Grand Theft Auto V. These like games that are live forever. So like one game stays forever and you try to draw everyone into that one game and you make a game and it doesn't work, you kill it. You know, like that's sort of like how the business works now, which is different, but similar. Anyway, all of which is to say, like, it severely restricts our cultural pathways while also giving a lot of power to executives to decide what kind of stories we hear. And the kind of stories we're going to hear are stories about how awesome it is to make money and work and have a family. Maybe that family, like, you know, if you're lucky, it's like a Pixar movie and like that family has two moms, but it's still like a nuclear family where both people work, right? Like, it's like these sort of stories, like the best you're going to get is like this very mild representation. And even that, you know, that representation was so intolerable to a portion of this country that, you know, we're living through what we're living through now.
This is the Final Straw Radio on the Pacifica Network, and you're hearing an event that I co-hosted with author Vicki Osterweil on her recent book, The Extended Universe, How Disney Killed the Movies and Took Over the World.
Especially with, as you point out, like the markets that these films are being produced for is not just to be palpable to the majority of people in the U.S. who are wanting to put money into it, but also to all of these other markets around the world too, which is not like nothing against universality or like stories that can be heard by a lot of different people. But if you're selling to the most, like the least common denominator of these situations, or something that'll like not only maybe make people in the U.S. excited, but also get past the censors of the Chinese Communist Party, it says a lot about what you're going to be.
Right, exactly. And China has overtaken the U.S. in 2021 as the biggest market by dollar volume. That's the biggest film market in the world. It has been the biggest film market by ticket since like 2013 or 2012, but they were making a lot less money. And yeah, like there was a rumor that I think I do talk about in this book. There was a rumor going on in the 2010s that one of the members of the censored board. So basically the way that Chinese market works really, really quickly, like all U.S. movies go through this censor board. Assuming it passes the censorship board, they also just select 10 or like 15 that are going to be allowed into theaters. It's like part of the planned economy. So you really want to like get your movie in, you know, because it's this huge market. I think it's more than that now, but it used to, you know, there's a quota basically. And there was a rumor that one of the three people on the CCP's board really loved Molten Gold. So every blockbuster for like 3 years, all the action blockbusters contrived a reason to have an image of gold melting. Sometimes it would be cut from the domestic release and it would just be in the international release. But like, that's the kind of level of like control that like sort of an arbitrary, and again, like, you know, that's a, I don't know how we, I don't know if that censor was really there, or if he really liked that, but that really happened in those movies. And like, if you think about these products that are being sold as like for everyone, and it has that level of like specificity of like trying to get through certain really narrow windows, or I think, you know, that's funny, more pressingly and seriously, they often will appeal to so-called Chinese anti-Black racism, which like, you know, is just different from US anti-Black racism, obviously, or, you know, you can't show a same-sex kiss in Chinese cinema. And I think, and there's certain levels of sex that you can't have in a lot of the UAE and Middle East places where there are also censors that they're interested in. They're smaller markets. They're less influential than China, but it also matters. So like, you know, the desexualization of superheroes, you know, like how they get turned into sort of like, you know, these mired in grief, realist people in stripped down military gear instead of, you know, at least like ridiculous, horny, bodacious adolescent camp fests, you know? Part of that is literally just about being able to sell it everywhere, right? Where it's actually going to make money. And I think so often in our discussions of that politics, we talk about the particular filmmaker. Oh, this filmmaker like made it so straight. Oh, this actor. And like that can be more or less true. But there's like this bigger structural thing going on that is like dictating like the levels of sex that are on, like movies, one of the most horny things that we have culturally, like have been desexualized by the fact that like it needs to sell in markets where there's more control over sexuality formally. And again, this is not to like, as you're pointing to, I think it's really important. It's not to be like, you know, damn those Chinese, you know, like that's not what I'm saying. Obviously, like it's about the ways in which, because those Chinese predilections are also being combined with US predilections about like certain forms of like morality and work that they wouldn't recognize in China, right? So you're sort of getting ideological, this sort of base stew of ideology from everywhere that's like really garbage. And you're getting everyone's garbage and it's being like mixed into this one big ugly garbage product and sort of shoved down your throat. It's fun.
You bring up the increased cost of movies over the last few years and just how they've become an avenue for investing a huge amount of international capital, And so they're way over production cost, like for the actual need of what they're producing. And I wonder if you could kind of explain how money is being legally laundered through this form and what it does for those that can invest in it.
Yeah. So this is something that I'm going to do my best. I don't want to this is above my pay grade, as they say. But basically, as I understand it, and having researched it and written about it and thought about it, there's a sort of common thing that people say critically about CGI, which is technically correct, which is that CGI is cheaper than live action stunts, right? You've probably heard this at some point. That's a critique. That's why they use so much CGI. Yes, one CGI worker is cheaper per hour than one unionized worker on set. And like, that's real. But movie budgets haven't gone down. Movie budgets have gone up and up and up. They've ballooned. Movies are more expensive than they ever have been before. If the goal was driving down the costs on the production side, then they're doing a very bad job of it. In fact, I would argue that, I just don't think that's a motivating factor. I don't think that makes sense as a description of it. And because I was stuck with that, I was like, well, that doesn't make any sense. Like, I started, so I looked into it and whatever, and other people have talked about this, obviously. But what CGI does allow you to do is spend almost infinite money on labor costs, which are non-taxable, right? The person who gets paid the labor gets hit with the tax bill. Hollywood has long been a series of tax dodges dressed up in the Oscars, And that's like famously people making their first movies who go out to Hollywood, get this deal where they're like, you're going to get 30% on the end profits. Like, this is incredible. And then they get $0, right? Because there's just all these elaborate arcane financial instruments. And Bank of America, for example, one of the things that founded Bank of America was funding Disney and early Hollywood studios. Financialization is extremely early to movie making because they're so expensive to make. So anyways, so you can basically you can just keep putting more hours into digitally manipulating an image. You can just keep doing it over and over again. You can ask for redos. You can do the thing called pre-visualization, which they do, which is where before a movie's even been made, a digital team starts making the movie images. Directors often now come on. A lot of the movie's already been made when the director shows up. They're really like a hired gun pointing a camera. Like, they're not, Anyway, so there's all this stuff that you can do, which allows you to make this investment, which obviously means that your capital isn't sitting in a bank. But with a franchise movie, the next Star Wars movie or the next Pirates movie or the next whatever, you are almost guaranteed to make money. Because even things that flop in the US, like, people here don't know that there was the Lion King live action remake in 2019? That's right, 2018. People really don't know much about it. Or the second one. The second one flopped even harder. Was Mufasa. That was Barry Jenkins. That was the movie he made after Underground Railroad. Was this Lion King prequel. No one knows about it. It was the seventh most successful movie of all time because international markets just buoy it. It doesn't matter. Like, stuff can flop in the US. They'd prefer it didn't. They want it to hit here too. That's more money. Anyway, the point being, franchise and IP combined with global market control has made movies an extremely safe investment in a certain way, which they never were before. Movies were always famously like a casino. It was a gamble, which is often why, there's stories of people, especially in the 60s and 70s when independent production really took off in a big way, consortiums of dentists losing their shirts, because they all are like, we're going to make a movie, we're going to be producers, There's sort of this myth that's, it's a really famously...
I feel like that showed up in Ed Wood at one point.
Totally,
Mormons came in and they're like, we're running this, we're going to make this movie.
Yeah. Exactly. So it has become a yet another financial instrument. But part of the reason also that it's a successful financial instrument, a movie, is because even if it fails, if you can get a chunk of the back end stuff, streaming revenue, merchandising, theme parks, then it doesn't even matter. Because as long as you're sort of part of this sort of corporate funding stream, you're gonna get your money back. Because again, these corporations, the movies are advertisements for the rest of the corporation. And those corporations aren't putting most of those upfront costs down on the movie because it's so desirable to financial investors.
A lot of the book, which is very well researched, I felt like I was learning a lot about these huge corporations just finding ways to change the laws in order to concentrate their wealth more and more. And I was really happy when you started talking about fan culture as a way of agency getting injected into this conversation. And for better or for worse, you gave examples of times when fan groups got together and were able to influence the way that the products that they were organizing around were made. I wonder if you could talk a bit about just sort of the positives and the negatives related to fan culture.
Totally, yeah. It's really important. I think it's the thing that probably is the most immediately relevant to most of us, the way we move in the world, the cultural world, you know, and experience it. So, you know, and on the positive end, like, so David Graeber, this is a crowd that actually knows who David Graeber was. David Graeber used to tell the story about Occupy that, like, so during the first week of Occupy, we were like 30 weirdos in a park in New York. We were completely surrounded by NYPD. They never came in and like cucked our heads, which would have taken them 15 minutes probably. Like, they never did it. There was a big question internally, like, why did that happen? We want to know, just like, you know, to reproduce it or whatever. And one of the stories that came up was that David Graeber overheard two cops talking about it. And because people were wearing Guy Fawkes masks, this is 2011, right? The cops were like, we're going to get hacked. Like, we can't hit those guys, you know? And like, you know, class cop brain, obviously. And like, you know, of course, if they had been ordered from above to do it, they still would have done it. That's not the only thing. But what that means is that for a moment, the Guy Fawkes mask, which even at that point, like, this was a funny story in 2011, even at that point was like basically a cringe political symbol of like being an online libertarian, for a moment kept the police at bay from smashing a movement that then would go on to become an international flashpoint that would kick off a decade of struggle in the United States, right? That has nothing to do with how good that movie is. Similarly, in 2014, during the Baltimore uprising, teens were talking about it and they were putting up posters and they were like tweeting about it as like, we're going to go purge tonight for Freddie Gray. We're going to purge for Freddie Gray. Now, the first The Purge movie, although it has some like interesting, there's interesting stuff in it that gets pulled out in the later sequels, which I think are quite good, some of them. The first Purge movie is of anti-crime home invasion fantasy where like this white guy defends his house like from, you know, deranged criminals. Like that's an extremely reactionary movie. It didn't matter. There was an anti-police uprising that partially was moved by the image of The Purge. A third example, during the anti-monarchy protests in Thailand in 2014, that was the first wave of them, Thailand's military had a very, very strong political censorship. You couldn't use political slogans. So what the youth activists started doing is they started doing the salute from the Hunger Games, which is like these three fingers together. Again, this has nothing to do with like how much they felt liberated by Jennifer Lawrence, but it was this like sort of universal symbol that allowed them to communicate with one another in a way that was opaque to the police, right? And so the monarchy didn't understand until it was too late that they had used the symbol that was immediately understood as a symbol of resistance. Whereas other symbols from Thailand's revolutionary past would have immediately been cracked down on. And then in 2019, when Thai people came back into the streets, that symbol had become completely autonomous from, it had nothing to do with the Hunger Games anymore. It had become its own symbol of Thai resistance, right? So in an essay called Notes on Deconstructing the Popular, the critical theorist Stuart Hall talks about this a lot. He mentions, and this is a paraphrase, I do a bad job, I really should get this quote down because I use it all the time, but where basically he says, today's revolutionary anthem is tomorrow's greatest hit, right? The Weather Underground were making bombs to Jefferson Airplane songs that now sell Pontiacs, right? Like that's just like how it, that's how it works. And sometimes that can be really fast. During Occupy, there was this occupation of this artist space, this thing called Artist Space in New York. Someone put graffiti on a bunch of their posters. The occupation got evicted. The next day, those posters were being sold on an auction site as an authentic Occupy object for like $40,000, right? Like as an art object. So like the art world's very good at doing that very fast. It can happen very, very quickly. But that was a genuine object of resistance one moment and then a commodity the next, right? Okay, so it's not in the nature of the commodity. Similarly, I think we're all familiar with the extremely important role that Gamergate and its sort of offshoots, which included like an anti-Star Wars harassment campaign, had in the building of the far right, Trump's meme magic, right? A lot of these folks met each other, got organized for the first time within Gamergate. Sometimes it gets overcredited, you know, they're like, oh, it was like Steve Bannon and Milo Yiannopoulos like sitting in a smoky room. It's like, no, those guys are idiots. But like, you know, they saw what was happening, which was like a bunch of aggrieved white people were like getting organized to harass women, and they used them those as organizing spaces to move in, and it was effective. It was important, and it was part of the birth of the current fascist movement in America. Fan cultures like that are extremely, extremely effective at sort of organizing certain kinds of rage, they're much more likely to function through franchises, because to build a backlash to a totally new thing, that totally new thing first has to become really popular. But to build a backlash to the new Star Wars movie, I just have to hear a description of it, right? And there's already communities that are there that are ready to talk and like organize about it. Similarly, there is a salutary effect for the studios. Counterintuitively, much like COVID, it feels like they'd be really horrified by this. And sometimes individual directors and producers are horrified by the harassment campaigns. But in aggregate, it makes their workers less willing to go out and say anything political, less willing to take risks with the franchise, less willing to not listen to the executives, because the executives have let them know and have shown over and over again, you're on your own. If the fans don't like you, we'll cut you from the series. We don't care. We don't need you. We need the character that you're playing, and we don't even necessarily need this particular character at this particular time. If you look at what happened to John Boyega in the three Star Wars movies, which I talk about, right? In the first one, he's like the most interesting character that the mainstream Star Wars has come up with in a long, long time. He's a stormtrooper who sort of like, you know, gets out of it and like sort of joins the resistance, and he's also black. And fans were so angry about it, and were like, because he was black, obviously, these reactionary fans who were a tiny percentage of the Star Wars fandom were so vocal and so organized. And Disney just like, you can watch it happen from the work print that got released, the first one. God, the subtitles are so bad. Episode 7, whatever it was, not Rise of Skywalker, that's the last one, that's total trash. Oh, never. You know, the work print that produced the controversy, he's less present in the final version. Then he's a side character in the second version. And then he's basically a background character in the third movie, right? Like, these campaigns are like really effective at driving the content, but the content, like Disney likes them because they keep their wages down. He could be a star. Instead, or Daisy Ridley, who is the star of those three franchises, got so much harassment for being a woman that she had to delete her Instagram. Now, this is a low stakes thing for most of us, obviously. But if you're a movie star and it's really mercurial business or any entertainment business, your social media following is a calling card, right? It is like a way you can raise your cost. So the fact that she doesn't have any like makes her cheaper to get and hold. Similarly, like the Marvel heroes, like those actors, like they it represses your wages to be at the whims of angry fans.
This is the Final Straw Radio on the Pacifica Network, and you're hearing an event that I co-hosted with author Vicki Osterweil on her recent book, The Extended Universe: How Disney Killed the Movies and Took Over the World. Hi again, KPFA listeners. This is Bursts from the Final Straw Radio, inviting you to mosey on down to support.kpfa.org, where we make it easy for you to make a one-time, or, if you choose to join the illustrious Guardians of KPFA, a recurring tax-deductible donation to support this bastion of community radio for the spring fund drive. You can also find more info there on other ways to donate, such as vehicle donations, employer matching plans, stock donations, or wills or trusts. It's always good to have a plan, and there are so many ways to support your community through keeping it rich in up-to-date and critical information in these days of rife disinformation and right-wing corporate propaganda. I'd also like to take a second to thank those folks who've been able to support the station in the past to get us to this place that we're at now. KPFA is a very special station for a very special region. It's been here for us when we've needed it, so this is a great time to give back by visiting the site I mentioned, or checking out the thank you gifts that are there, or by giving a call to 1-800-HEY-KPFA. That's 1-800-439-5732. Thank you for allowing me this pitch, and I hope you enjoy the rest of the show.
We also bring up the fact that IP theft in the form of, for instance, the Punisher logo being used by right-wing groups is something that hasn't really been challenged, but it also falls into the benefit of the company to allow that to happen, right?
Exactly, yeah. And I think we were talking about this beforehand, but like with AI famously, like Disney can literally win a lawsuit with like God, basically. But they like haven't taken out any AI companies, even though those AI companies have like gone on the New York Times and been like, we've stolen all of Disney's work and we think it's great to steal it. You know, like basically like we did the crime, you know? And the reason they don't sue them is because they don't give a shit about being copied. That's not what matters. It doesn't matter. What matters is the power over the image making that the copyright allows them. And so they don't actually care about the act of stealing or reproduction. That's not what's at stake. What is at stake is control. And AI companies offer them more control over the image, not less. So they don't care if they like actually are like reproducing their back catalog. That's not, it's never what it's been about. It is a convenient, they will always argue it really, really intensely, obviously, but like they also, I mean, as we were just speaking about beforehand, which like I didn't even get in the book, like, you know, the Lion King, the famous Lion King opening is stolen from that Japanese TV show from the 60s. Like Hollywood people steal the pitch screenplays from them all the time. And those screenwriters bring cases in the Fifth Circuit of Appeals, which is like the Hollywood, basically where all Hollywood cases happen, and they always lose. Because Hollywood's like, nah, it's just like it's the judges just throw it out. It's generic. It's too generic. You know, they're like, look at this. My dialogue was stolen. Like I pitched Sony Universal and Warner Brothers, whatever, whichever. No, Warner Brothers, Paramount on this last week. You know, today here they are in Variety announcing this thing that's clearly my story, but they rejected my pitch. And they're like, no, you can't prove that. You know, so it's always to the like defense of the best lawyered and the most powerful, and it's always going to hurt the small person, even when the small person is right that they have in fact been stolen from. Always is probably too strong. There are probably instances where it goes the other way, but like, again, those are used and held up as exceptional. And in fact, it's actually shocking how unfrequently the intellectual property system works to the advantage of people who get robbed.
Where do you see hope in terms of creativity and bumping up against these huge industries that have the governments wielding these laws? Like within the realm of fan culture, there's fan fiction that's created. There's like tons of examples you could give of those being repressed or being sued out of existence, but people find ways to reproduce. Like storytelling is really important for the way that we live with each other and the way that we imagine what's possible. And for better or for worse, characters that Disney owns the IP for are formative parts of how we identify ourselves, how we feel about these things. And yeah, I wonder, like, I mean, there's piracy. There's like, mm-hmm. continuing to try to find creative ways to recuperate those characters back or detorn them or whatever. But yeah, I wonder if you have any.
Yeah, I mean, piracy and movie projection and like media sharing has never been easier technically than it is today. I think like I see a lot of hope in stuff like sort of underground or just like friends or even on Discord server, like movie clubs that people just form autonomously and they don't even think about the fact that they're breaking copyright. Like, it's not interesting. It's not really what they're doing necessarily, where people are, or maybe they do think about it, you know, where they're sharing the culture they want to share and talking about it and having discussions in their own spaces. I think that that's a good start. I think, like, you know, as we are going through these many, many crises, one of the things that has happened, like, in Philly, and I think everywhere, there are, like, empty movie theaters. In Philly, we had a crew that projected movies for a whole summer on the side of the abandoned movie theater. You know, we could break into them and start using them. I'm a big believer in, like, similarly, like, when it comes to medicine, right? Like, if we talk about pharmaceutical companies, pharmaceutical science is, like, 30% some of the, like, most valuable, impressive, interesting, important science that has ever been done by humanity, and 70% complete. But the answer that like Maha would offer you is like, throw it out, you know, put a leech, you know, drink some silver and like put leeches on your body or whatever the hell they're selling right now. But it's like, no, steal the 30%, right? Break their patent, figure out how to compound the medicines, figure out how to make them for each other. Because as we face more and more collapses of infrastructure and of logistics and their systems, we're increasingly going to need to be able to do that anyway. But even if we didn't need to, even if it wasn't a survival question on that level, that's what makes it affordable. That's what makes it possible. That's what makes it possible for us to take care of each other. On a cultural level, making stuff, just making stuff and sharing it with your friends. I think like one of the things that I think people are increasingly accepting is that there is no path through the mainstream without extreme luck towards like viability financially as an artist. And that sucks. Like that does suck. It's bad. There's a bad situation that you can't make money doing art. Like you have to do it as a side hustle. That's like, that really sucks. And the only way we'll really have free flowing creativity and culture is when no one has to pay rent to live inside and when no one has to pay money to get medicine, right? That's the only way we'll really have true culture. But in the meantime, making stuff for your friends, just like doing stuff in community, I think it's like, it's such a small answer and it's very similar to like the mutual aid answer, right? Like, which as we saw in Minneapolis, like does scale. It will scale. It can change an entire social fabric. And when you do it enough, and also like in Philadelphia, where I live, like there was this thing that was made, I think in 2019, which was just like a Signal chat just designed to share raves, right? Because raves can't publicly, you know, they don't have a venue, they can't publicly. And out of that chat, a ton of the organizing around 2020 emerged, and continually mutual aid organizing comes out because you've just created a space where people are already hanging out and where people are already talking to each other. And culture like brings people together, and that's like really powerful, and like that can really be overlooked. And we can get too, in a way, too invested in the content of the culture rather than the content of the space that it produces.
I mean, I feel good about those. Do you want to turn to the audience?
Yeah, definitely. I'd love that. Yeah, if people have questions.
I really like how you opened with the fact that enjoyment is still a very real part of this, no matter how much you know it is evil. And I think, too, like, you can get a lot of morale from these things. Like, if I'm to watch a show like Andor, which is made by the mouse himself, it's still a really, really powerful show. And I'm just curious what you think about that kind of disconnect between these companies making some genuinely very great pieces of art that have great theory within them. But
yeah, I mean, in some ways, I mean, Andor is an outlier. Like, I don't think there's an MCU product you can point to and say the same thing about. Black Panther's as close as you get, and that's literally a movie about how cool it would be to gentrify San Francisco, ultimately. But, like, you know, I think, like, so Andor is, on one hand, an outlier, as I said. Also, it's rad that it happened and that people enjoyed it. Like, that was cool. I'm glad people shared it. Again, to go back to 2020, during the uprisings in Philly, one of the things that happened is we had two big home unhoused encampments pop up and stayed all summer, and we won some demands, we won some housing. But like, one of the things we did during that was like project movies on a screen on the backstop of the baseball diamond on the field we were like occupying, right? Like, and I think that like that pleasure is still like, there's still utility to it, right? We can still use it. And like, I think we'd never think about this as a question if we like, when we like with music, right? Like, certain songs become anthems of like a moment, you know, and often they're put out by one of the three, you know, by Sony or BMI, you know? But I think with movies, because they're, or TV or visual, you know, televisual media, because you feel less active doing it somehow, because you can't really do other things while it's going on, because it's in the dark, I think we think that it's less social. I honestly think like making them more social is cool. But in terms of that contradiction that you're talking about, I'm about it. Like, I think some movies really suck and are reactionary, and I will make really vigorous arguments about it with you. But I'm interested in having that conversation, you know, like most of the time. And I think those conversations can be really generative. Again, like, I think what really matters is the way that we use them. Like, culture is ours to use. No matter what they say, no matter how many symbols they put on it, no matter how many police they send after you for reproducing it, ultimately it's ours to use, and we should use it the ways we want to. And if that includes just, but like, it's ours. It has always been ours. It comes from us. They stole it. They put fences around it. They called that a copyright. Take it back.
So I think Disney in recent years has had this sort of gloss of progressivism, and maybe in particular as a result of the conflict in Florida with Ron DeSantis. I think a lot of people have this idea that Disney is sort of somehow on the liberal progressive side of things. But in your book, you talk about the extremely and kind of rabidly right-wing politics at the kind of origin point in terms of anti-communism, labor busting, and things like that. I'm wondering if you could talk just a little bit about what the political culture of the Disney Corporation, maybe not just right now, but historically has been.
And, you know, like, speaking of things that are ours, like, part of the reason it has that reputation is because, for example, a lot of queers in Florida have historically gone to work at Disney World. And so it is like, Orlando is actually kind of a gay city in some ways, as a result. But if you work anywhere on Disney property, you have to sign NDA saying you can't talk about anything. So anything we know about labor practices in the Disney Corporation since like 1984, eight is technically hearsay.
If you're listening to the radio edition, we invite you to hear a slightly longer audience Q&A with Vicky in the podcast edition, subscribable at tfsr.media or streamable at our website. This is The Final Straw Radio.
Fascism. History is shaped by our actions. It is shaped by us together even when it is hard. History is ours to write. History is ours to shape. So the question is, are we going to do that? The question is, are you going to join us?
KPFA, Sounds of Resistance since 1949.
The KPFA Local Station Board is expanding its community outreach and welcomes short presentations from representatives of local community organizations. The board is looking forward to learning about your organization, its purpose, and how it serves the community. Contact outreach@kpfa.org to find out how you can speak at the upcoming online meeting on Wednesday, May 13th during public comment at 7:15 p.m.
You are listening to 94.1 KPFA, 89.3 KPFB in Berkeley, 88.1 KFCF in Fresno, and online at kpfa.org. Coming up next, Against the Grain with Sasha Lilly. But first, the news.